I don't know about you, but I'm a traditionalist, and if you've been in the church for a while, I just can't get used to those new lyrics, although they're very fitting, and maybe they're more appropriate. I don't know if according to the scripture. I haven't checked it, but it just struck me that, well, it kind of throws me for a loop. That one does, because it's so different. The wording is so different. In 1623, Governor Bradford of Plymouth Colony made the following proclamation. No, I was just kidding. Mark and I were joking a little bit about, okay, there goes that and that and that. We're joking about our topics, and both had the same general topic, and I appreciate what he had to say very much. When considering the national holiday of Thanksgiving, how many Americans are really going to be thankful for everything that they have and all the blessings? And do they really understand that God has indeed blessed this nation? It used to be a pretty common thought expressed in society that God himself had blessed our peoples, or at least it was universally thought so, that we trace the origin of our blessings back to God Almighty. And that was at a time in which more people actually believed in God. According to reports, there are fewer and fewer people every year that actually have any belief in God whatsoever. So to be thankful to God, to them, or to that group of people who don't believe in God would be silly, but that is the basis of which a national Thanksgiving holiday comes from anyway, is giving thanks to God. That original, or the origin of Thanksgiving, is traced back to the Plymouth Colony, as Mr. Mark Tannert said, and that most successful harvest of 1621 was a time in which they celebrated, because the year before had been a disaster in 1620. They hadn't had a good harvest at all, and they were near starvation, as a matter of fact. But the next year, in 1621, they had a harvest that included goose, lobster, cod, venison, and the Wampanoag Indians. Well, they were guests. They weren't part of the menu, but they were invited to the harvest. Then on October 3rd in 1789, George Washington made the National Thanksgiving Proclamation. That was the first such official proclamation ever in the United States, made by our first president. Now, where does the national day of Thanksgiving actually come from, the day being actually set in stone and actually coming to be? Well, that was the work of a writer, a poet, an editor by the name of Sarah Josepha Hale, who is from New Hampshire, I believe. And she began in 1846 to write to each president of the United States. And she was relentless, and for 17 years she campaigned in her publications and also in her letters to the presidents of the United States. And it took four presidents for them to finally recognize, up until the time of Abraham Lincoln in 1863, recognized her work. But she is the one that championed the idea of having a national holiday. But not only that, before she was successful in championing a national holiday and having the president make such a proclamation and establish it as a national holiday, she had been successful with most of the governors of the United States, even prior to the Civil War, of having statewide celebrations. So she was an incredible person. And so in 1863, President Abraham Lincoln, in the midst of civil war, established a national day of Thanksgiving. And then in 1939, President Roosevelt moved the date from the fourth Thursday of the month to the third Thursday of the month. And some of the people at the time, and some people have thought since that time, that basically what he was doing was trying to give merchants a head start on Christmas buying, because normally people wouldn't be doing anything for Christmas until Thanksgiving was over with. So once Thanksgiving as a holiday was over with, then people would concentrate on the next holiday. And of course, that has become one of the things that the Thanksgiving weekend is most remembered for. That it's not for Thanksgiving and not for thanking God for all the blessings of harvest and And we're not necessarily reflecting as a culture that is not so agriculture in nature, not looking at that so much. Probably we should, because people fail to recognize that there's land and there's farms and that's where the food comes from and everything that they're giving thanks for on that special day of Thanksgiving. But most of the time now, the Thanksgiving holiday is noted in most people's minds for the incredible bonanza and binge of shopping that takes place. So some people think that President Roosevelt was trying to extend that shopping period and thus help try to springboard out of the Great Depression, which the United States was in at that particular time. Whether that's true or not, I can't really affirm or not. But the fact is that if you go back to 1939, there were a lot more people that actually believed in God and actually gave thanks to God, and especially on the day of a national Thanksgiving. And there's nothing wrong, by the way, with the day of national Thanksgiving at all. It's not a holy day, obviously. Sarah Hale, by the way, is best remembered not for being something, a champion of something that would give thanks to God in a national way, because she felt very, very strongly about this. She's best remembered, incidentally, for her nursery rhyme, "Mary Had a Little Lamb." Who knew? But some people think that she kind of plagiarized that from another earlier author. So, but she explained it that lambs following children to school was fairly commonplace in New England. Really? Well, it was a different age. It's possible, but anyway, I don't know if she plagiarized it or not. But prior to the proclamation by President Lincoln, Thanksgiving was not universally celebrated everywhere. Most of the states had adopted something, but President Lincoln giving it that seal of approval really kind of set the date in history. But today, the world that we live in and the blessings that we enjoy, you and the church know, we all know that we trace all of those blessings as a nation back to God. And it's a day that I think a lot of people and a lot of nations can embrace. One of the most memorable Thanksgivings I ever had prior to marriage was at Ambassador College in England, in which the English church members would, for that time, adopt an American for that Thursday, and that they would have a Thanksgiving dinner for the American students on campus. And of course, that would spread to all the students, and they would all be invited outside of the campus to some of the English families. And so there was a girl in my class who was a member of my class, and she was English, and she lived not too far, her parents lived not too far away from campus, and invited a number of, I think, three Americans over and had a nice turkey with all the trimmings and all the stuff that we had. And so they adopted Thanksgiving. It's kind of a nice thing to do. And hopefully you'll have the opportunity to do that with your family this Thanksgiving Day and really keep it in its right and meaningful way and giving thanks to God for everything that he has blessed not only us individually and as a family with, but also as a nation. We look back, if you'll turn to Genesis chapter 12, it's a good time to remember that all that we enjoy, and we can be the most thankful people on the face of the earth as Americans, I believe, or at least we have certainly a lot better reason than a lot of places in the world to be thankful, and we still have the peace and safety and calm and tranquility. But as we prepare for a national day of Thanksgiving, we understand that the rest of the world is caught up in different ideas of what Thanksgiving is all about. It'll mean Black Friday the next day for a lot of people, with this shopping extravaganza that will explode upon us and be a prelude to the Christmas shopping season. It's kind of sad that it's linked in that way, but I guess we can thank Franklin Delano Roosevelt for that. No, it would have happened on its own. It would have happened all by itself, obviously, because that's the way things generally go. But the blessings that we enjoy and that we look to God and we're thankful for this coming Thanksgiving go back 3,500 years ago to this man, Abram, in Genesis 12. In verse 1, now the Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family and from your father's house to a land that I'll show you. I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And as time has gone on, and the tribes of Abram and the tribes of Israel grew, certainly you can see many different touch points in history before they rebelled against God and stopped keeping his commandments. You can see many touch points in which entire nations, probably a lot smaller nations than we have today, but they were blessed by the work of the descendants of Abraham. Egypt, they turned against us. They turned on us hideously, but they were blessed as a result of just having, as it were, the sons of Jacob, and Joseph certainly being one who preserved that nation and made it possible for them to be blessed. And then throughout the centuries, there have been certainly many, many different times in history in which nations have been blessed because of these descendants. Turn to Genesis chapter 22 as we go over this review of what happened with these folks after Abram. Genesis 22, these blessings, God gave bountiful blessings, and he proclaimed this in verse 15. Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham, his name now being changed a second time, out of heaven, and said, by myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, Isaac, was ready to sacrifice as God had commanded him, his own son, but it was a test. He says, because you've not withheld your only son, blessing I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven. Now looking up in the whatever ability that Abraham had at that particular time, and looking out in the stars, he knew their lot, he knew they were uncountable, but didn't have any idea. So it was like that. But he didn't live long enough, obviously, to really comprehend the nature of what would happen. We, looking back now, can see how many millions upon millions and billions of people have been blessed as a result of Abraham's obedience to God. Also, he said that they would be as the sand which is on the seashore. So that's, again, incredible. Multiple billions of descendants through the centuries. And your descendants shall possess the gates of their enemies, some of them still within the control of those individuals. Those blessings were passed on to the sons of Jacob and then to Joseph. And they're still in the hands many times of the sons of Joseph, the descendants of Joseph, even up until this day, because the name of Israel and those blessings were passed on basically to his great-great-grandsons, Ephraim and Manasseh. We covered a little bit of that last week. But millions and millions of descendants would possess the gates of their enemies. And then notice Genesis 25. We're coming into something that you probably understand and take for granted in a way that even students of the Bible may not even comprehend this totally. So this is an interesting, this transference of the blessings, how it came about in Genesis chapter 25 and verse 21. You know this, but a lot of other people don't. Even Bible scholars really don't comprehend this. They look at it from a different point of view than you would. In verse 21, now Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah his wife conceived. But the children struggled together within her. So she had twins. If all is well, why am I like this? So she went to inquire of the Lord. She was troubled. You know, the babies are casting about in the womb. And the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb. Two separate people shall be separated from your body. That is amazing. one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. We know what's coming up. So when her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed there were twins in the womb. And the first one came out red, and he was like a hairy garment all over, so they called his name Esau. And afterward his brother came out, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. They were totally and completely differently, even it appears from a kind of a genetic sense, although related, the appearance of one is just totally different than the other one. And so they couldn't have been more different as they grew up, as the following verses describe. Totally different individuals, one kind of a farmer, one kind of a hunter maybe, but they were totally different in terms of their personality. And as we find through the chapters of Genesis, this Jacob was a skillful individual in many ways, and he was very cunning. He was very crafty, and getting towards the end of this chapter, we see this guy is a wheeler dealer. He is somebody that is cheating his brother, in a sense. Who would do that to his own brother? But Jacob did. He was a scoundrel. He was a bad guy. I mean, here his brother is hungry. The brotherly thing would be to give him something to eat. But no, he kind of makes him pay for it, right? And so, what does he say? Esau, in verse 30, said to Jacob, "Please feed me with some of that same red stew, for I am weary." Therefore his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright as of this day." Wow, I mean, the birthright, he's the eldest. He is due a substantial portion of his father's inheritance, because that's the way it was. Then Jacob said, "Swear to me of this day." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils. Then he ate and drank and arose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. He didn't hold out. He just capitulated and he gave it up. So it says something about the two individuals. It says something really bad about Jacob in terms of his conniving and his cunning. And it also makes a statement about Esau and his disregard for what he had. So a lot of Bible scholars, if they even put everything together, which many times they don't, but if they recognize the national blessings that came along with the selling of the birthright, they would lay it all to this. So the question is, was Jacob cunning and deceitful? And obviously you can see that he was not a good person. But the question is, was this the determining factor in deciding who would receive the blessings from Abraham? And the question is decidedly no. Absolutely not. All this passage does is show us the difference in the two individuals who grew up. It doesn't determine who gets the birthright blessings. It has nothing, absolutely nothing to do with that. It's not because Esau said, "Oh, I just easily give it up," that he got it. The decision was not theirs to make. I mean, Jacob could be cunning, he could be deceitful, he could try to cheat his brother, but God had already determined what was going to happen. So we see that for proof, actually, moving forward. In Genesis 26, in verse 1, notice this. "There was a famine in the land, besides the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went to Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, in Gerar. Then the Lord appeared to him and said, 'Do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land which I shall tell you.'" I said Jacob. I'm sorry. Jacob. So, okay, now we're into Isaac. All right. "Do not go down to the land of Egypt. Live in the land which I shall tell you. Dwell in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give all these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham, your father." So the blessings are again mentioned here in verse 4. "I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of the heaven. I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice, kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. So all of those things that we find codified later on are mentioned by God as Abraham being obedient to them. All the things that would be wrapped up from the book of Exodus all the way through Deuteronomy were already being kept, apparently, by Abraham. So Isaac dwelt there. And we move on a little bit further. Everything that happened between Jacob and Esau, we'll turn to chapter 28 in just a second, but everything that happened between Jacob and Esau is really immaterial. I mean, they had their brotherly ways, they did what they did, but God himself conveyed these blessings to Jacob, and that was somehow understood by Isaac. We're not told how, but in Genesis 28, somehow that came, that recognition came to Jacob. It wasn't because he had just cheated his... I mean, do you think God is going to allow, just because Jacob was able to put on hairy garments, and do you think God is going to allow Jacob just to steal something that is not his? He can't, you know, that would be inconsistent. Well, Jacob stole it, so I guess, you know, God's sitting up in the third heavens, I guess I've just got to go with what these boys have done. You know, one's a conniver, I'll teach him some lessons later. No! Genesis 28, then Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said, you shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. Arise, go to Padam Aram, the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take yourself a wife from there of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. Now, may God Almighty bless you, make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may be an assembly of peoples and give you the blessing of Abraham. Now, they had a lot of years to evaluate the two boys, the strengths, the weaknesses, what they did good, what they did badly. But it's obvious that God made it clear to Isaac that those blessings from Abraham would go to this individual, and they wouldn't go to the other individual. They would not go to Esau. For whatever reason, God had determined that, to give you the blessing of Abraham to you and your descendants with you, that you may inherit the land in which you are a stranger, which God gave to Abraham. Now, the rest of the story we know quite a lot about. The cunning and deceitful Jacob ran into the cunning and deceitful Laban and was taught a lot of lessons, and we covered some of that last week in the sermon, France and Prophecy. We covered also Genesis 48 and 49 and Deuteronomy 33 in assessing these ancient prophecies from the point of view of how we're affected today. So I don't know that you could say that it's considered a doctrine or a teaching of the church, that which I included in my sermon last week about France and Reuben being, or France being perhaps the modern-day counterpart or the descendants of Reuben. That is not something that we would just hang salvation on. But I believe it, and you're free to believe it or disbelieve it. We can, you know, talk about that. But I believe that's correct, and I think that it's very likely that when you see the attacks that happened last week by these Muslim extremists, it's done from these descendants, some of them from the descendants of Esau or Edom, and then, you know, the descendants of Ishmael, both of which intermarried, by the way, as the Bible even shows. And so there's a lot of mixture of those people that we would call Arab, or that we'd call their religion Islam for the most part, very few Christians and Jews sprinkled along their populations throughout. In Deuteronomy chapter 27, Moses gathers all the elders of the tribes together, and I think oftentimes I've looked at Deuteronomy 27 is very separate from 28, but it's really not. It's really in the same discourse that he's calling all of the tribes and the elders of the tribes, and he's giving them the instruction to be obedient to God. In verse 1, now Moses with the elders of Israel commanded the people, saying, keep all the commandments which I command you today. And it shall be on the day that you cross over the Jordan to the land which the Lord your God is giving you, that you shall set up yourselves large stones and whitewash them with lime. And you shall write on them all the words of this law when you have crossed over, that you may enter the land which the Lord your God is giving you, a land flowing with milk and honey, just as the Lord your God of your fathers promised you. So this was some of the beginning of those blessings that were coming to the tribes of Israel and to the people of Israel as a result of Abraham's blessings. And then in Deuteronomy 28, of course, the very famous blessings and cursings chapter, we see that there's blessings for obedience to God and all that he is all that he has commanded Israel. And we know that also this group of people and their immediate descendants through the next few hundreds of years would forget those laws, and they would forget all that came before, and they would go into captivity because of that disobedience to that law. And we also know that thousands of years later, after they had already gone into captivity, that there was a group of people that Mr. Tannert mentioned in the sermonette. I mentioned in the sermon last week, and we can revisit and rethink that now. People who fled religious persecution and through a lot of trial and agony and effort and starvation and everything else, and never had it anywhere near as good as the poorest American has ever had in his life in the modern age. They sat down on a Thanksgiving day and they looked to God, these people who had escaped religious persecution. We spent a lot of time on that last week. I won't do that today. But they looked to God under the most dire circumstances. I mean, if you were to transport the average American back to 1621, he'd look around and say, what? We're used to air conditioning and lights in the nighttime and, you know, the convenience of having everything that we want. And the poorest of Americans lives like a king by comparison. And it's good, I think, to remember from whence we have come and from whence our forefathers come. Now, some of your forefathers, probably some people, I don't know, maybe one of you can trace, not you, some of you can trace your historical antecedents back to Plymouth Rock. But it doesn't matter. If you've come to this country, you are blessed beyond measure, and much more so than any other nation in the world has ever been. And the Western nations of the European nations have also received great, great blessings, have a high standard of living and incredible wealth. But if you were to go back to Plymouth Rock, somebody that was famous or wealthy in that colony or just shortly after, let's just say the mid-1600s, a wealthy man would own a horse and he could ride a horse. A poor man would not have a horse. Today, a poor man can have an automobile in much of the developed world. He may not have as nice an automobile as a rich man, but the gap has closed, even though all we hear today is that that gap of between the have and have-nots gets increasingly bigger, but it's really not. The truth is that a very poor person who has access to a vehicle, and even if he has access to public transportation, fares much, much better than a wealthy man of 100 years ago or 150 years ago, certainly back to the time of Plymouth Rock. You may not own a Mercedes. You may own a, what's considered a bad car these days? What's considered a really horrible car that nobody would want? I don't want to say it because some of you may own one of those cars. So anyway, if you have a bad car or a beat-up car, the point is that if it's drivable, it will still go probably as legally fast as a very expensive car. That's true. And so you have access to transportation. You have access as a very poor person in our society today that people never had before. And if you get on an airplane, The rich man is not going to get to the destination any faster than you. He may sit in first class and you may sit in the cabin back, but you're still going to be treated like a first class citizen. If you're on an airplane, you're going to get to your destination at about 550 miles an hour, just like everybody else. So the question I know that comes up is, you know, when we see things like happened last week happen, where do we stand in Bible prophecy? And what point are we? And I don't know that we can really determine that or ascertain that. It does appear as though for all of the Western nations, they live in a pivotal time in which it is very, very dangerous. And if you live in a metropolitan area, and certainly there are rumors that these Islamic radical terrorists could strike at any time. And you probably read the news reports or heard the news reports about people being stopped in Central American countries with fake passports, and people just down here in Sonoyta being captured who they found out were very likely individuals had snuck into this country under false pretenses. And so it happens and it continues. So we don't really know, but Leviticus 26 said that I will break the pride of your power, and I'll make your heavens like iron and your earth like bronze, and that will come to pass in totality at some point. But right now we know that we still have incredible things to be thankful for. So in that verse, and looking back over my years in the church, I remember at times when we lost the war in Vietnam. We had to leave. You know, the embassy, the U.S. embassy, was just given up in 1975, and people flying off in helicopters, and Americans being evacuated. And that was seemingly a point at reference where Leviticus 26 and verse 19 seemed to come true. And it was a very, very difficult time for us as a nation. Or a few years later, I remember when just after Terry and I had been married, we'd only been married a few short years, and we lost our embassy in Tehran, Iran, and that was overrun with, and our people were hostages, and they were kept for hundreds and hundreds of days until finally Ronald Reagan came into office and the Iranians let them go. And or you could go back even further to times with the attack on Pearl Harbor and World War II and over. Overall, it just seems as though wherever we have been or wherever we think we are in the framework of Bible prophecy may not have that much relevance as time goes on. So it's kind of difficult to really, you know, say that those times were the end-all be-all in terms of this prophecy in Leviticus coming true and the blessings running out. Right now we know that we live in peace and calm and safety, generally speaking. Right here, right now, we're okay. In Genesis chapter 49 and verse 22, in speaking of the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and then Jacob, who blessed Joseph's sons, and he called those two sons collectively Joseph in this prophecy. And he said, Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. But his bow remained in strength. The one thing about this nation is its resiliency, despite many attempts to take it down. And the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. By the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you with the blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lie beneath, blessings of the breasts and of the womb, the blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors. Up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills, they shall be on the head of Joseph, and on the crown of him who was separate from his brothers. He was separate. He was sold into slavery. He was a separate individual, and he's been very, very resilient. And through my lifetime, we have survived a lot of things that have come upon our nation, attacks, an oil embargo of the 1970s, where some of you weren't even born, and we can drive by now, and the price of gas, I think relative to the price of the value of the dollar, may not have ever been cheaper in our lifetimes. Even when I remember buying gas for 30 cents a gallon in my Volkswagen, my 1964 Volkswagen, my first car, and we drive up and the price of gas remained between 28 and 30 cents. They'd have a gas war and it'd be down to 27 cents a gallon at times. But now with, I don't know what the price of gas is today, about $1.89 or something like that in some parts of Tucson. I haven't done the math, but I think that it may be relative to the value of the dollar, one of the cheapest commodities that we have ever had in our lifetime. But maybe not. We can figure that out later. But it's still a great blessing for people to have. And now the United States is the world's largest producer of oil. And we still import a lot of oil, but almost none of it comes from the Middle East. The only thing that they're really important for is, you know, if they keep churning out lots of oil for the rest of the world, then it keeps the rest of the world afloat. But we have had a lot of other things that have hit us as a nation. We've survived the last 8 years, and that's got to be worthy of something. So, so many things that have happened during my lifetime, and I don't mean to make this about my lifetime. Some of you have shared in that, obviously. Of course, before my lifetime, my parents survived two world wars. Their lives were on the bridge of those, both of those wars. I grew up during the Vietnam War. There's been a couple of Gulf Wars, a couple of Iraq Wars, the threats of communism. That didn't work out so great for communism in the latter part of the 80s and the 90s. But we look out now and we see that America is absolutely hated. And some of the other nations of Israel that we look back and we think that we can identify in Genesis 49 and Deuteronomy 33, some of them are hated as well. And we're coming to find that out. That ancient enmity between the sons of Edom and Ishmael are coming to fruition, and they will come to fruition. It seems to be coming together. But there is that ancient jealousy for which they did not get and which they never have had. And God not only gave wealth, he gave a gift of tenacity to the sons of Jacob to overcome and to solve their problems. And when you think about it, all that the financial blessing that we have had, a lot of it is dependent on natural resources and that we have developed here and elsewhere in the world. But without the ingenuity of the United States and Britain, that incredible resource of Arab oil would have still been in the 15th century in the ground waiting to be explored if it hadn't been explored and drilled for by the United States and British many years ago. So, not many people would admit it, but for many, many years, the United States has made the world a better place, the British Commonwealth of Nations before that. And so we come up to a National Day of Thanksgiving, and we've got a lot to be thankful for. And I, like you, tend to look at the world from the scope and what is happening in the world and what we ought to be thankful for from the standpoint of what has been revealed to us in Bible prophecy. And in Luke 21 and in verse 36, I think sometimes commonly misapplied in the past, Luke 21 and verse 36, and I'll explain that comment, which says, "Watch therefore and pray always." When I first came into the church, there was a great emphasis on watching world events and watching what was happening in the world and being aware of that. And that's good. And that's an appropriate response of a Christian. But that's not what this passage means. And certainly doesn't mean it exclusively. It may have a tertiary benefit of watching what's happening in the world. But Christ is speaking to his disciples and he's talking to them about their own spiritual condition. Pray always. That has to do with us. Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. Now this prophecy is very similar in nature. It's the exact same prophecy as Matthew 24. And so if you go back to Matthew 24, the very next chapter after Matthew 24 is Matthew 25, and that is definitely speaking to people who know better. The kingdom of heaven shall be likened to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were wise and 5 were foolish. I would submit to you that being thankful to God and being spiritually aware of your own environment and your own standing with God is one of the things that is being spoken of here in Matthew 25 and is helping us to prepare as individuals in a spiritual way. There's a warning for a purpose. God's people need to be very, very thankful. I just wanted to allude to that, but I want to go back to Luke 21. And in verse 7, and the companion is in Matthew 24, but in Luke 21 and verse 7, it says, the disciples, speaking of the disciples, they said, "Teacher, but when will these things be, and what sign will there be when these things are about to take place?" And he said, "Take heed that you be not deceived, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am he,' and the time is drawn near. Therefore, do not go after them. But when you hear of wars and commotions, do not be terrified, for these things must come to pass first, but the end will not come immediately." Then he said to them, "Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and there will be great earthquakes in various places, and famines and pestilences, and there will be fearful signs and great signs from heaven." And in verse 20, "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know the desolation is near." So we put together a lot of parts of prophecy from Daniel, from Matthew, from Revelation, and realize there will come that time in which Jerusalem is surrounded by armies. Daniel calls it the king of the north, and it's precipitated by the king of the south. "Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people. And they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive to all nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled." Just a very short period of time that's still in the future. "And there will be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars, and on the earth distress of nations, with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's heart failing them from fear and the expectation of those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of the heaven will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Now when these things begin to happen, look up and lift your heads, because your redemption draws near." Then he spoke to them a parable. "Look at the fig tree and all the trees. When they're already budding, you see and know for yourselves that summer is now near. See you also, when you see these things happening, know that the kingdom of God is near. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away." So the correct understanding of generation is age, genea, which means age. It doesn't mean a strict generation of 25 or 30 years, so it doesn't do anyone any good to begin counting years and applying this particular prophecy, because it's a time period in which these things are going to happen. And not that just studying prophecy is going to make you spiritually aware. A lot of that comes along with a lot of other things in your life. It's one part of life. It's not the most important part of life. It's not more important than loving God. But you can't count back the length of time of a generation and figure out when Christ is going to return. What's more important is the attitude of the individual Christian. In verse 34, again, take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and the cares of this life, and that day come upon you unexpectedly. Being thankful is not a national thing. It's an individual thing that occupies our lives every day, not just today. We can get together today in a potluck and rejoice and really have a good time and be thankful for all the great food and everything that has been prepared and the fact that we can have it. But being thankful is an attitude of daily existence for a Christian. If you're not there at that point, then, as it says, these times will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the earth. Turn to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. And to the Thessalonican people, the brethren there, they were going through some difficult times and trials and difficulty. And no matter what the times, whether good or bad, this is the information that we all need to keep close to us. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 16, rejoice always. Rejoice always, no matter what the circumstances. Pray without ceasing. In everything, give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you. Christian recognizes that whatever happens in his life, whatever occupies his existence, there's something to look for and be thankful for. The Weymouth translation says in verse 18, in every circumstance of life, be thankful, for this is God's will in Christ Jesus respecting you. The New Standard Revised Version says, give thanks in all circumstances, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you. So my encouragement, my plea is that the National Day of Thanksgiving be just a springboard for all of us to celebrate Thanksgiving every day. James, in chapter 1 and verse 2, even in difficult times, and I guess something that we might consider difficult times in today's age would be considered light and transient duty in times past, you know, from at least a material perspective. Anyway, James said, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. You've heard people say, I know I need more patience. I just wish I had it now. Just wish, you know, I wish I could get this trial over with so that I could develop more patience. Well, there are all kinds of trials of various sorts. And in this nation today, still, we can be thankful to God that we don't have a lot of those kinds of difficult trials that people elsewhere have to face. In Matthew 5, the Beatitudes express some of the greatest teaching, and for most of mankind, some of the most contradictory teaching that has ever been given. A lot of thoughts that are contrary to human nature are given in this so-called Sermon on the Mount, which Christ is just sitting down and teaching his disciples, apparently, his 12 disciples, and then a number of other disciples, but not the entire multitudes. But at the end of the sermon, and it says in verse 28 of chapter 7, so it was when Jesus had ended these sayings that the people were astonished at his teaching. And I take it that it was not the masses who had followed him or the great multitudes, but it was just simply to his disciples, and maybe even those individuals, speculation here a little bit, maybe even those individuals who would be the beginning of the New Jerusalem church were the ones that were privy to hear this and to hear this wisdom and this information. But in verse 11, I'd like to hone in on this, or pardon me, in verse 13. Christ said, "You are the salt of the earth, a seasoning for all of mankind." And I think that he was specifically referring this to just a few, not many, not the multitudes, but he was speaking to a few people. Matthew 5 and verse 13. I'm sorry if I was unclear on that. "You're the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned?" We retain the flavor. We remain the salt of the earth by remaining thankful to God in all times, no matter what the course of action is that is happening. If it loses its flavor, it is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. In like way, it says, "You're the light of the world, and a city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden." And there was a very famous quotation that Ronald Reagan used a number of times in speeches that he gave about this nation, about how this nation has been a beacon for many peoples around the world. And he illustrated with the Statue of Liberty, which I mentioned last week, a gift from the French people. And this nation, in that sense, has kind of fulfilled that on an international sense for many, many years. But it's not as though the feelings and the attitudes expressed in this greatest of all sermons are really captivating to our entire population. And thus, we find that people are probably not as thankful in this nation as they ought to be. And their thoughts on a National Thanksgiving Day will revolve around maybe a couple of football games, a nice dinner, to which a lot of people are going to overeat, maybe a few arguments around the dinner table or whatever, lack of thankfulness. But people, fewer and fewer people every year, unfortunately, are looking to God for the thanks of the many blessings that they do share, and they don't recognize him as the one that is given to them. But no nation in history has been as blessed as this nation. And we should be thankful. And I hope that you have a great Thanksgiving day with your family and friends, whoever they might be. But I hope that every day will be a day of thanksgiving for the people of God, for the many things, and especially thanking one another and being thankful for one another that you can fulfill this incredible role of being salt to the world in a seasoning, in a sprinkling to society, in giving thanks to God, especially on this National Day of Thanksgiving coming up.